book, Even the Terrible Things Seem Beautiful to Me Now, is out in hardback on Hope, Loss, and Wearing Sunscreen, winner of the 2012 Pulitzer Prize for Commentary. You may have seen the first edition, similar title, and some of the columns are the same, but some of them are different, some exited, and some new ones are in the latest issue. If you like Chicago, if you like good storytelling, if you have a collection of books about this city, then this one needs to be in there, and if you don't, you should start one now. Mary is in our studio. Hi, Mary. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for that.
Is that a fair description?
Those nice words, John.
It's so true. How hard is it to, you get this all the time, right? Come up with a column as often as you have to? Is that the hardest part of your job, thinking of the idea?
I would say that is one of the hardest parts of my job. Dealing with the aftermath of columns and living in public, as you may know, is also difficult. But yeah, coming up with three ideas a week for 27 and a half years now. Three ideas that I can execute responsibly and well. Three ideas that I think might have enough appeal to enough people. There are weeks when that is really hard and weeks when it's not so hard.
Yeah. But the craft itself of then writing, once you have the germ of the idea and you like it, then the words come.
I wish it were that easy. No, I mean, every single one is a challenge in a new way. It never gets easy. I think people think that it does. I mean, maybe it's easier now in ways that I don't recognize than it was in the beginning. It's easier to the extent that I know I can do it.
It reads easily. It doesn't look labored at all.
Yeah.
And yet you labor over it.
Easy is difficult.
Yeah, yeah, maybe so. You also said the aftermath. Is that a new phenomenon, or what are you talking about there?
Well, you know, especially the world we live in now of social media, email. It's like everything you write gets a huge response. And that's very gratifying when it's gratifying. It's also really exhausting when it's exhausting. Because everybody wants to pick apart everything you do. And again, you know, this is just part of the job. I'm not really complaining. I'm just describing.
Sure.
And it is extremely gratifying to have people read what I write or, you know, in your case, listen. I mean, it's one of the greatest gifts we can ever get, that people would pay any attention to what we have to say. But it does come with a lot of, I think, demand that people don't recognize.
When I find myself judging or passing judgment on somebody's bumper sticker, and I think, why would somebody put that on the back of their car? And then I think, John, you are a human bumper sticker.
Exactly.
You are nothing but driving down people's roads, spewing opinions, some of which you wish you could scrape off the back of your bumper at the end of the day. So give these people a break.
Or some of which you wish you had articulated better, more clearly, whatever.
Most bumper stickers are better than me, that's for sure. But Mary, you don't write about politics that often. You don't write about the president that often. You do some scathing and funny poems about Donald Trump once in a while. But you've stayed out of that arena. I thought somebody like you would be a little more insulated from some of the quick criticisms that the rest of us are subjected to.
Oh, no, no. I mean, so here's my philosophy about writing about politics. The world is so much bigger than politics. Now, you could argue that everything is politics, but let's not have that argument right now. I have always approached my column with the belief that most of us, most of the time, until fairly recently, are thinking about things besides politics. But even that, you know, you write about someone you love dying. You write about mental illness. You write about some socks you like. This happened to me just yesterday.
Socks?
Yes.
Are we going to get a socks column soon?
Oh, well, I mentioned my socks fetish in the column. And I've heard from several people who just want to argue with me about, you know, socks.
Wait,
somebody wants to argue about everything. So if you write about mental illness, someone you love who has a mental illness, many people will write to connect with you on that, share their own experience, but other people will take issue with a word that you use. So it's just complicated.
And that's a topic that you've written about. You've written about your very strange family. You wrote about your sister. You and I were talking about this a little bit off the air. It was one of the columns that, was that in the first edition or is that?
Yeah, it's in the first
edition. It's in the first edition as well. Tell me a little bit about your sister.
My sister is maybe the most amazing person I know, but I think it's taken me a long time to fully understand that and to fully appreciate her. She is the eighth of eight children. She was born with some physical problems, but mostly just mental challenges, which were never properly diagnosed. She was born in the 1960s, where, you know, even she herself will say to me sometimes, she goes, you know, Mary, they just didn't have very good psychiatry back then, did they? And I go, no, Gina, they didn't. You know, she probably today would be diagnosed as somewhere on the autism spectrum. But she has other things going on. She's had many diagnoses. I don't want to go into them here. But she is so strong. I mean, I don't want to romanticize it. But she is so deep. And it really took me, I think, until the last 10 years of my life to fully comprehend the life that she is living inside the body, inside the mind, that she was granted. And that really, she is me.
She is you.
She is me.
What do you mean by that?
She's so much like me. It's just that she's got a slightly different wiring. And the older I get, the older she gets, the more I understand that.
Yeah, it's funny how as we get older, our siblings get older, we start to see some of those connections. And when we like them or don't, but there they are, right?
Right.
You said that about your parents, too, or your father, that the older you get, the more we may resemble our parents. When your mother passed away, your sister lived with your mom.
Right.
And you were worried that when your mom passed away, how would your sister get along? And lo and behold, she rather flourished, didn't she? She became a much more responsible or competent person when suddenly she had to, right?
Yeah, and again, I don't want to simplify that because she still has a complicated life, but she'd always lived with our mother and was extremely dependent on our mother. And me and my siblings just really thought she would fall apart, and we didn't know what to do. And instead of falling apart, she just mustered something.
Yeah.
Again, don't want to romanticize
it. No, I'm not asking you to.
Don't want to simplify it. But she has managed to live independently in the almost 10 years since our mother died. And no one ever thought that would be possible.
Well, I'm related to it. And I think anybody who's got family members whose independence you're not sure about would read this and relate to it in very personal ways. You wrote also, so some of your columns are like that, very personal, and maybe the rest of us can connect on some level. And then at other times you write Chicago stories, The Boy and the Bullet. His name was
Tavon Tanner.
Tavon Tanner. And did that appear originally as a series of columns, or
no,
was it just one long piece?
No, it wasn't really. I mean, I think of it more as a story. It was a very long 6,000 or so word story that I wrote about Tavon, who was shot on his porch in the summer of 2016, and it looked for a while like he might die. And it was in a summer when a lot of kids were getting shot.
Yeah.
And so I set out to figure out, you know, what's a story we can tell that makes this fact of Chicago life feel real, feel important, and not just, you know, oh, another kid shot, which is the way I think a lot of people process it. And his mother, Melanie, and he were just remarkably open, and Jason Wamsgans took these remarkable photos that won the Pulitzer for photography. So that's an example of a story that I have gotten to tell.
You told the story we mentioned before you came in of the walking man in Chicago. You have a really beautiful piece about Roger Ebert. Now let's tell some more Chicago stories with Mary Schmeek after this. Mary Schmeek's in our studio. Even the terrible things seem beautiful to me now is her latest book. It's a compilation of some of her award-winning columns. Why the title, Mary? It's been told before, but tell us what the title means.
My mother, when she was in, I think, the last year of her life, I was visiting her in Oregon, and I went out, and she was looking at the roses, and my mother never cried, despite her very difficult life, and she was crying just a little bit, and I was so startled by it, and she said something like, "I think you have to be old to understand your life." And then she said, "Even the terrible things seem beautiful to me now." And I remember at the time thinking, well, Mama, I'm writing that down.
Whatever this moment is, I just got a column out of that.
And then
Shame on you.
I joked for several years, you know. I said, you know, someday I'm gonna write a book with that title, never thinking that I really would. And then we were looking for a title for my column collection. And I threw it out there thinking, you know, people would roll their eyes. And Colin McMahon, who was overseeing this project at the Tribune, said, "I like it."
Hmm.
So there you have it.
What did she mean by that?
Even the terrible things seem beautiful to me. I think it's pretty obvious, right? You know, you go through your life and every day, oh my God, this is so hard. I'm so afflicted. Things are going to be terrible. The world is exploding. My life is exploding, blah, 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 blah. My mother had many, many moments when she could have fallen victim to that. But it's like at the end, you just go, oh, that was life. That was my life.
I wonder if that's something that, okay, I got it, and I believe that about a person late in life. I wonder, as a younger person, can I use that? Can I value that? Can I actually see through the crappy times and know that someday I'm going to look back on this and have a better perspective, you know? Hopefully.
I think sometimes you can, and I think that is part of the value of words. That is part of the value of our well-articulated ideas, that when you hear the words, you carry those words, you know, like little talismans, stones in your pocket, and you just, you know, you reach for them and you rub them and you go, okay, someday this terrible thing will look beautiful to me, even if it's really hard to convince yourself.
Right. The title of her book is "Even the Terrible Things Seem Beautiful to Me Now." Good that Mary's ear heard that from her mother's lips and put it in this perspective. She also wrote Friday, April 5th, 2013, about Roger Ebert's passing in a column entitled "Roger Ebert's Lesson in Dying." I don't have time to read all of it to you here, but I just wanted to share a couple of sentences from it. Roger Ebert was a hot trend on Google's top 10 trends earlier this week. You started the column. And you later in the column said, "Ebert deserves to be remembered for something more, dying with grace. Some people die quickly, others a little at a time. Ebert faded slowly, dramatically, with a philosophical flourish. In the past few years, doctors had cut out his thyroid, then part of his salivary glands, then a piece of his jaw. He could no longer eat, drink, or talk. A different person might have shrunk into despair. Ebert navigated his way out of the depths through writing, along with a connection to young people, a reliance on new technology, and a humility that verged on bravado. In a 2010 piece in Esquire, read it if you haven't, he allowed his ruined face to be photographed in close-up. His deformed jaw and permanently open mouth filled a full glossy page. His eyes still shone. When I am writing, my problems become invisible, and I am the same person I always was," he said in that piece. "All is well. I am as I should be." A while after that, he engaged in a political battle via Twitter with a conservative who gleefully mocked his cancer and his disfigurement. Ebert tweeted back, "You want ugly? For that you have to look at a mind, not a face." Oh, that's just so well told. And what a great wit and brain and writer he was, wasn't he, Roger?
You know,
Ebert.
One of the great things about writing in Chicago, which I realize more and more all the time, is writing in this constellation of people who have written in Chicago or who have been on the radio, you know, who have been granted this great grace and opportunity of being a public voice. And there are just so many of them. And to be part of the constellation is like, I don't think it hit me, honestly, until relatively recently that I went, oh, I've been able to do that for 27 years.
Maybe that's why people are texting in and saying things like, John, please tell Mary thanks for the warm column about the passing of Larry Dunphy. I live near the family. He was a wonderful man. Thanks for the radio program and for the Tribune newspaper. You must get that all of the time, too.
Thank that listener, reader for reading. Means a lot to me.
You wrote about Walking Man. We were kind of laughing about him or recollecting some of our intersections with Walking Man. Is he still alive, do you know?
I passed him, and his name is Joe, which we didn't know until he was attacked. I saw him a month or two ago.
Yeah, no kidding. And he still walks around the city.
Yeah, slower than he used to.
Hair is whiter than it once was. Does he still have the full mustache, the healthy mustache?
I think so.
Did you see it?
I don't remember.
You tell about how he got mugged, and I don't remember that episode in his life, but I sure think of him as just this sort of solitary figure wandering the streets, and I wonder, how does he pay his bills? Where does he live? What does his family say about him? You track down a sister-in-law? Was that who you talked to?
I think that's who it was.
Yeah. Who just recollected a little bit about his story. It's in this book. You write about the optimism in Barack Obama's voice. Not just his tenor, but literally the words that he would choose. Why did you write about that?
Well, the phrase I use for it is the discipline of optimism, because I think it's really easy to mock optimism, to mock optimists, to equate optimism with naivete. And Barack Obama incarnates what I think of as the discipline of optimism. It's like your default is not cynicism. It's not that there aren't times to be cynical. And I think Barack Obama just over and over and over in his public life, which I think is a relatively true reflection of his private self, he encouraged us to think optimistically, to not go to the ugly place first. And that is a discipline. That is something that you resolve you will do. Not go to the ugly place first. Not go to the cynical place first.
Even though that would be your gut reaction. Even though that would be an honest reaction. You get angry. You write, for instance, I mean, this is the president who had to talk to us after Sandy Hook. And after 9 black parishioners were gunned down by an angry white man in a Charleston, South Carolina church. You write about the 49 people dead in a gay club in Orlando and all of the times that Barack Obama had to talk to us in moments like that. You wrote, optimism isn't quite the same as hope, no matter what the thesaurus says. To my ear, hope is a fluffier thing, that pretty flower that springs spontaneously from the dirt, no gardening skills required. Optimism, on the other hand, is hard. It can take work. It demands focus in the face of contradiction. It's a habit of mind, and like all habits, it can be difficult to cultivate and easy to lose. But maybe especially in this day and age, I'm speaking now, not Mary Schmeek, it would be good for us to sort of find that tool in the box and try and use it a little more.
Yeah, and it is just a tool in the box. It's not the same as saying, oh, everything's great, everybody can relax, no worries. It's not that. It's just not going to the dark, ugly place first all the time.
Yeah. And people say, well, you got to be realistic, or you use the word naive if you don't have those feelings or see that side of the story or the world. But I think you can and then say, but I'm going to be optimistic. But that was all those speeches Barack Obama gave. He said, this is terrible. This sucks. It's awful what happened. But then he had an optimistic, hopeful tone about it at the end. By the way, Songs of Good Cheer, is that sold out, Mary Schmeek?
Songs of Good Cheer is sold out. But what I always say about sold out is that you never know. There are always some tickets that turn up at the last minute. Always, always, always. So if anybody really wants to go, call the Old Town School the day of.
The Old Town School of Folk Music in Chicago hosts their singers, their staff, and Mary Schmeek and Eric Zorn of the Tribune, the columnists, who are talented musicians and singers. And all of these people go on stage, and then we all sit in the audience. We buy tickets. The proceeds go to charity, I believe.
A good portion of them.
And we sing Christmas songs. And some of them are familiar, and some of them are not at all. It is the most fun, perfectly cheery experience you will ever have.
And you've come many times, John, which we thank you.
I will be there again this year. Songs of Good Cheer. Yeah, try and get tickets. And if you can't this year, do it next. Also pick up Even the Terrible Things Seem Beautiful to Me Now, Mary Schmeek's latest collection. Thank you, Mary.
Thank you, John.